Chapter 93. Affording an explanation of more mysteries than one, uncomprehending a proposal of marriage with no word of settlement or pin money, the events narrated in the last chapter were yet but 2 days old, when Oliver found himself, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, in a traveling carriage rolling fast towards his native town. Mrs. Maley, and Rose, and Mrs. Bedwin, and the good doctor were with him. And Mr. Brownlow followed in a postchaise, accompanied by one other person whose name had not been mentioned. They had not talked much upon the way, for Oliver was in a flutter of agitation and uncertainty which deprived him of the power of collecting his thoughts, and almost of speech, and appeared to have scarcely less effect on his companions, who shared it, in at least an equal degree. He and the two ladies had been very carefully made acquainted by Mr. Brownlow with the nature of the admissions which had been forced from Monks, and although they knew that the object of their present journey was to complete the work which had been so well begun, still the whole matter was enveloped in enough of doubt and mystery to leave them in endurance of the most intense suspense. The same kind friend had, with Mr. Losburn's assistance, cautiously stopped all channels of communication through which they could receive intelligence of the dreadful occurrences that so recently taken place. It was quite true, he said, that they must know them before long, but it might be at a better time than the present, and it could not be at a worse. So, they traveled on in silence, each busied with reflections on the object which had brought them together, and no one disposed to give utterance to the thoughts which crowded upon all. But if Oliver, under these influences, had remained silent while they journeyed towards his birthplace by a road he had never seen, how the whole current of his recollections ran back to old times, and what a crowd of emotions were wakened up in his breast when they turned into that which he had traversed on foot. A poor houseless, wandering boy, without a friend to help him, or a roof to shelter his head. See there, there! Cried Oliver, eagerly clasping the hand of Rose, and pointing out at the carriage window. That's the stile I came over. There are the hedges I crept behind, for fear anyone should overtake me, and force me back. Yonder is the path across the fields, leading to the old house, where I was a little child. Oh, Dick, Dick, my dear old friend, if I could only see you now. You will see him soon, replied Rose, gently taking his folded hands between her own. You shall tell him how happy you are, and how rich you have grown, and that in all your happiness you have none so great as the coming back to make him happy too. Said Oliver, and we'll take him away from here, and have him clothed and taught, and send him to some quiet country place, where he may grow strong and well, shall we? Rose nodded yes, for the boy was smiling through such happy tears, that she could not speak. You will be kind and good to him, for you are to everyone, said Oliver. It will make you cry, I know, to hear what he can tell, but never mind, never mind, it will be all over, and you will smile again, I know that too, to think how changed he is. You did the same with me. He said, God bless you to me when I ran away, cried the boy with a burst of affectionate emotion, and I will say God bless you now, and show him how I love him for it. As they approached the town, and at length drove through its narrow streets, it became matter of no small difficulty to restrain the boy within reasonable bounds. There was Sowerberry's the undertaker's just as it used to be, only smaller and less imposing in appearance than he remembered it. There were all the well-known shops and houses, with almost every one of which he had some slight incident connected. There was Gamfield's cart, the very cart he used to have, standing at the old public house door. There was the workhouse, the dreary prison of his youthful days, with its dismal windows frowning on the street. There was the same lean porter standing at the gate, at sight of whom Oliver involuntarily shrunk back, and then laughed at himself for being so foolish then. cried, then laughed again. There were scores of faces at the doors and windows, that he knew quite well. There was nearly everything, as if he had left it but yesterday, and all his recent life had been but a happy dream. But it was pure, earnest, joyful reality. They drove straight to the door of the chief hotel, which Oliver used to stare up at, with awe, and think a mighty palace, but which had somehow fallen off in grandeur and size, and here was Mr. Grimwig all ready to receive them, kissing the young lady, and the old one too, when they got out of the coach, as if he were the grandfather of the whole party, all smiles and kindness, and not offering to eat his head, no, not once. Not even when he contradicted a very old postboy about the nearest road to London, and maintained he knew it best, though he had only come that way once, and that time fast asleep. There was dinner prepared, and there were bedrooms ready, and everything was arranged, as if by magic. Notwithstanding all this, when the hurry of the first half hour was over, the same silence and constraint prevailed that had marked their journey down. Mr. Brownlow did not join them at dinner, but remained in a separate room. The two other gentlemen hurried in, and out with anxious faces, and, during the short intervals when they were present, conversed apart. Once, Mrs. Maylie was called away, and after being absent for nearly an hour, returned with eyes swollen with weeping. All these things made Rose and Oliver, who were not in any new secrets, nervous and uncomfortable. They sat wondering, in silence, or, if they exchanged a few words, spoke in whispers, as if they were afraid to hear the sound of their own voices. At length, when 9 o'clock had come, and they began to think they were to hear no more that night, Mr. Losburn and Mr. Grimwig entered the room, followed by Mr. Brownlow and a man whom Oliver almost shrieked with surprise to see. For they told him it was his brother, and it was the same man he had met at the market town, and seen looking in with Fagin at the window of his little room. Monks cast a look of hate, which, even then, he could not dissemble, at the astonished boy, and sat down near the door. Mr. Brownlow, who had papers in his hand, walked to a table near which Rose and Oliver were seated. "This is a painful task," apostrophe said he, "but these declarations, which have been signed in London before many gentlemen, must be substance repeated here. I would have spared you the degradation, but we must hear them from your own lips before we part, and you know why." "Apostrophe, go on," apostrophe said the person addressed, turning away his face. "Quick. I have almost done enough, I think. Don't keep me here." "Apostrophe, this child, apostrophe," said Mr. Brownlow, drawing Oliver to him, and laying his hand upon his head, "is your half-brother, the illegitimate son of your father, my dear friend Edwin Leaford, by poor young Agnes Fleming, who died in giving him birth." "Apostrophe, yes, apostrophe," said Monks, scowling at the trembling boy, the beating of whose heart he might have heard. "That is the bastard child." "Apostrophe, the term you use, apostrophe," said Mr. Brownlow, sternly, "is a reproach to those long since passed beyond the feeble censure of the world. It reflects disgrace on no one living, except you who use it. Let that pass. He was born in this town. Apostrophe, in the workhouse of this town," apostrophe was the sullen reply. "You have the story there." Apostrophe, he pointed impatiently to the papers as he spoke. "I must have it here too," apostrophe said Mr. Brownlow, looking round upon the listeners. "Listen then. You," apostrophe returned Monks. "His father being taken ill at Rome, was joined by his wife, my mother, from whom he had been long separated, who went from Paris, and took me with her to look after his property, for what I know, for she had no great affection for him, nor he for her. He knew nothing of us, for his senses were gone, and he slumbered until next day, when he died. Among the papers in his desk, were two, dated on the night his illness first came on, directed to yourself. He addressed himself to Mr. Brownlow, and enclosed in a few short lines to you, with an intimation on the cover of the package, that it was not to be forwarded till after he was dead. One of these papers, was a letter to this girl Agnes, The other a will. Apostrophe, what of the letter? Apostrophe, apostrophe, asked Mr. Brownlow. The letter? A sheet of paper crossed and crossed again, with a penitent confession, and prayers to God to help her. He had palmed a tale on the girl, that some secret mystery, to be explained one day, prevented his marrying her just then, and so she had gone on, trusting patiently to him, until she trusted too far, and lost what none could ever give her back. She was, at that time, within a few months of her confinement. He told her all he had meant to do, to hide her shame, if he had lived, and prayed her, if he died, not to curse him memory, or think the consequences of their sin would be visited on her, or their young child, for all the guilt was his. He reminded her of the day he had given her the little locket, and the ring with her Christian name engraved upon it, and a blank left for that which he hoped one day to have bestowed upon her, prayed her yet to keep it, and wear it next her heart, as she had done before, and then ran on, wildly, in the same words, over and over again, as if he had gone distracted. I believe he had. Apostrophe, the will, apostrophe, said Mr. Brownlow, as Oliver's tears fell fast. Monks was silent. The will, apostrophe, said Mr. Brownlow, speaking for him, was in the same spirit as the letter. He talked of miseries which his wife had brought upon him, of the rebellious disposition, vice, malice, and premature bad passions of you, his only son, who had been trained to hate him, and left you, and your mother, each an annuity of £800. The bulk of his property he divided into two equal portions, one for Agnes Fleming, and the other for their child, that it should be born alive, and ever come of age. If it were a girl, it was to inherit the money unconditionally, but if a boy, only on the stipulation that in his minority he should never have stained his name with any public act of dishonor, meanness, cowardice, or wrong. He did this, he said, to mark his confidence in the other, and his conviction only strengthened by approaching death, that the child would share her gentle heart and noble nature. If he were disappointed in this expectation, then the money was to come to you. For then, and not till then, when both children were equal, would he recognize your prior claim upon his purse, who had none upon his heart, but had, from an infant, repulsed him with coldness and aversion. Apostrophe, my mother, apostrophe, said Monks, in a louder tone, did what a woman should have done. She burnt this will. The letter never reached its destination, but that, and other proofs, she kept, in case they ever tried to lie away the blot. The girl's father had the truth from her with every aggravation, that her violent hate I love her for it now could add. Goaded by shame and dishonor, he fled with his children into a remote corner of Wales, changing his very name, that his friends might never know of his retreat. And here, no great while afterwards, he was found dead in his bed. The girl had left her home, in secret, some weeks before. He had searched for her, on foot, in every town and village near. It was on the night when he returned home, assured that she had destroyed herself, to hide her shame and his, that his old heart broke. Apostrophe, there was a short silence here, until Mr. Brownlow took up the thread of the narrative. Years after this, apostrophe, he said, this man's Edward Leaford's mother came to me. He had left her, when only 18, robbed her of jewels and money, gambled, squandered, forged, and fled to London, where for 2 years he had associated with the lowest outcasts. She was sinking under a painful and incurable disease, and wished to recover him before she died. Inquiries were set on foot, and strict searches made. They were unavailing for a long time, but ultimately successful, and he went back with her to France. There she died, apostrophe, said Monks, after a lingering illness, and, on her deathbed, she bequeathed these secrets to me, together with her unquenchable and deadly hatred of all whom they involved, though she need not have left me that, for I had inherited it long before. She would not believe that the girl had destroyed herself, and the child too, but was filled with the impression that a male child had been born, and was alive. I swore to her, if ever it crossed my path, to hunt it down, never to let it rest, to pursue it with the bitterest and most unrelenting animosity, to vent upon it the hatred that I deeply felt, and to spit upon the empty vaunt of that insulting will by dragging it, if I could, to the very gallows foot. She was right. He came in my way at last. I began well, and, but for babbling drabs, I would have finished as I began. Apostrophe, apostrophe, as the villain folded his arms tight together, and muttered curses on himself in the impotence of baffled malice, Mr. Brownlow turned to the terrified group beside him, and explained that the Jew, who had been his old accomplice and confidant, had a large reward for keeping Oliver ensnared, of which some part was to be given up, in the event of his being rescued, and that a dispute on this head had led to their visit to the country house for the purpose of identifying him. The locket and ring? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Brownlow, turning to Monks. I bought them from the man and woman I told you of, who stole them from the nurse, who stole them from the corpse, apostrophe, answered Monks without raising his eyes. You know what became of them. Apostrophe, Mr. Brownlow merely nodded to Mr. Grimwig, who, disappearing with great alacrity, shortly returned, pushing in Mrs. Bumble, and dragging her unwilling consort after him. Do my eyes deceive me? Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Mr. Bumble, with ill-feigned enthusiasm, or is that little Oliver? Oh, leave her, if you know it how I've been a-grieving for you, apostrophe, hold your tongue, fool, apostrophe, murmured Mrs. Bumble. Isn't natter, natter, Mrs. Bumble? Apostrophe, apostrophe, remonstrated the workhouse master. Can't I be supposed to feel I has brought him up parochially, when I see him a-setting here among ladies and gentlemen of the very affablest description? I always loved that boy, as if he'd been my own grandfather, apostrophe, said Mr. Bumble, halting for an appropriate comparison. Master Oliver, my dear, you remember the blessed gentleman in the white waistcoat? Ah, he went to heaven last week, in a oak coffin with plated handles, Oliver. Apostrophe, come, sir, apostrophe, said Mr. Grimwig, tartly, suppress your feelings. Apostrophe, I will do my endeavors, sir, apostrophe, replied Mr. Bumble. How do you do, sir? I hope you are very well. Apostrophe, this salutation was addressed to Mr. Brownlow, who had stepped up to within a short distance of the respectable couple. He. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.